Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and my mother and co-host, Caroline, is visiting with some of her other children and grandchildren today, so she's not with us. So our guest today is Adam Hammes, author of Sustainable Business in Iowa, How Leading Companies Profit from Environmental and Social Responsibility. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Adam.
Thank you, Monica. It's really great to be on. It's pleasure to talk to you again. I grew up really close and we knew each other when I was a baby.
That is true. That is true. From from his early childhood, not mine, because Adam was a classmate of my daughter's, actually. Mm-hmm. And we were neighbors and we were family best friends for a time. And I was really thrilled to reconnect with Adam after all these years. And of course, I showed my kids your book. I took it down to Austin with me the last time and showed it to Adrian and Tony.
Well, and thank you very much.
Yeah, and they were both impressed, but not surprised, because you always were an achiever.
Well, thank you. It's hard to change when you just you kind of be a certain way, and you're just that way your whole life.
That's sometimes.
Yeah.
There can be some changes. But Adam, what drew you to your, you know, interest in sustainability? Because you not only have written a book about it, you have studied it, you have worked in this field pretty much your entire adult career, if I'm reading things correctly.
That is correct. I think sustainability, it's a really broad topic. So I came by way of corporate sustainability. You know, it took me a while to have it all, but just in general, I think understanding social, environmental, and financial issues. I studied business in school, but the social and environmental, you know, my family, we, on the social side, my mom was always a caregiver and kind person, and I have a special needs younger brother. And so I think I got exposed to some realities in my world as a kid, just that some people don't have it equally. And we volunteered for Special Olympics and did all kinds of different things growing up that I just met a lot of people who were less fortunate, and it was to no fault of their own. And I think socially, that's probably where I got that bent from. And environmentally, we grew up loving the outdoors, playing outside. We were on a farm all the way away from everything. So I really enjoy just being outdoors. And when you love a place, and especially you want to protect it. So as I grew up and saw things happening, it just interested me in preserving those things so that not only I could enjoy them, but our future generations could. So I think that's where it started. Just I had a lot of exposure to things as kids. And when I grew up and got into college and started studying what I wanted to do for a career, I had a mixture of things. A good friend of mine in high school passed away my freshman year in college from a motorcycle accident. So I really sort of was finding myself and changing my major and just really not sure what I wanted to do. And so I bounced around from business management information systems to, they called it Leisure, Youth, and Human Services back then, but it was basically nonprofit management. I had an environmental studies minor and I had a global health certificate, and I just did a bunch of different things in school and I enjoyed traveling. And so all of that being said, I just got a job leading trips outdoors and teaching environmental ed for adults and youth, and bounced around seasonally all over the place. The tagline is 4 continents, 7 countries. Really just doing seasonal work in beautiful places, but I was typically a naturalist and I would teach leadership development and then we would just take fun outings, and it was all kind of wrapped into one. And then eventually I wanted to move up in those organizations and lead programs. I really enjoyed environmental education and that leadership development of people. But when I got into grad school, I was really focused on getting my MBA, and it was just, I got introduced to corporate sustainability programs and realized that there were things like green MBAs, and incorporating social and environmental performance into both financial and the other things that I wanted to do. So it was really in grad school I started reading books and getting introduced to companies that I switched, and I decided I don't want to run programs that educate people. I want to help companies learn that this is possible and that it's actually better business to do it this way. And in my opinion, I was like, if people knew that, if there was a way to do things that were environmentally and socially responsible while you were making money, then who wouldn't want to do that? So that was where I switched really in grad school. And then I just decided corporate sustainability was what I wanted to do for a living. When I got my first job, I started a nonprofit first because there weren't a lot of corporate sustainability positions. And by that, I mean zero and in Iowa. And I had moved to Des Moines to be closer to my family. So I started a nonprofit and started doing a lot of sustainability at the community level and then inviting corporate sustainability experts into Des Moines for speaking series and presentations and trainings. And then I got hired at Come and Go, and they were hiring a manager of sustainability. So I jumped at the chance and really, really worked on the environmental side strongly for them, but got to put together and pull the social in. I wasn't responsible for it, but was helping bring it all under the umbrella of quote unquote sustainability, creating a sustainability report and really building a program for a whole company. And that's really kind of how it has to happen. Very few people can be an expert in all the fields because sustainability, I mean, there's energy, water, waste, transportation, land use, climate change, and then socially there's diversity and inclusion, safety, health, and wellness, charitable giving and volunteerism, financial literacy is getting big, human rights. So nobody's an expert in all of them, but I kind of came the way of a broad education anyway, and then a broad MBA program. And so I was more of a jack of all trades and strategy person that got to work in environmental initiatives at Come and Go for 3.5 years. And then I left to start the Iowa Sustainable Business Forum so that other companies could share best practices with each other. And I've been consulting and running that industry association ever since. So it's this big whirlwind of bouncing around. I like learning about a lot of different things and how they connect and how they intersect. And that makes me a really good person for sustainability because you have to understand broad issues and how they not only relate to companies, but how they relate differently to different types of companies in different industries and what's most important and why. And so it was really kind of a long, long journey from childhood through college to Des Moines, Iowa, and through one really good company, Come and Go. I got a ton of experience, and now I couldn't, it's not to brag, but I just don't know that anybody else has had a chance to work with as many companies in Iowa as I've had a chance to work with, because after 3.5 years, I left to create this association. And really it's all I've ever cared about. So,
and how long have you been doing that?
The association, mm-hmm. ISBF is 5 years old and working on our sixth year.
Great. Great. Now I seem to remember one of the countries you were in for a while was Japan. Is that true?
Did I Correct. Get that right? And what did Okinawa.
You, Okinawa. And what were you doing there?
That was actually the first. It wasn't that wasn't super specific. I had never worked with kids or anyone before. That was just early in my college career. I wanted to travel. And UNI, my undergraduate was from UNI, has this camp adventure program, and they will just send students in the summers off to military bases to run programming for youth because they're parents are often deployed. And so I just jumped at the chance to take a free trip to Japan. And I did that. That was my very first international travel, was with Camp Adventure in Okinawa, Japan, working on an army base, teaching mostly swimming and leading like outdoor kind of like adventure weekend stuff for our students, just whenever we had other things that they wanted us to plan, like field trips. But It was my first time I'd ever led any kids, and it was I was terrified. I had no idea how to lead groups. I grew up a pretty quiet kid on a farm, and I was not a loud or didn't babysit for people. I just kind of worked with my dad. But when I got to do that and I realized it was not as terrifying as I thought, it was pretty fun. And that's how I got into a lot of the leadership development and taking people on trips to do like community service and naturalist type environmental education stuff.
Now, one of the issues that we have in Iowa, of course, is the youth brain drain, where a lot of kids who grow up here go to college here and then leave for other parts of the country or the world. And you followed that path, but what brought you back?
Well, I remember specifically, and I'd like to say it was a hard decision that was clear, but it was more of, as I studied sustainability and I traveled to all these places, make no mistake, it was fun. It was very valuable. I enjoyed it a lot. And I actually remember specifically going to Germany and working with these youth. And I was probably 23, 24. I thought pretty highly of myself. And we were, you know, very adventurous. And we thought we'd show up and we were these amazing role models. But I really got clear that there was an older gentleman, not older, older than me, he was probably in his 30s at the time. And he just kind of had this cynical view of us college students showing up and working with the kids in the community. And what he saw, which he showed us, and I really enjoyed spending time with them, is he just said, you guys don't really see these kids. They don't want to tell you the truth, like some of the hard stuff that they've had to deal with. You're fun. You don't know anything about them, and they love just having fun. But when you guys leave, you know, people like us have to stay here and, you know, keep their families together and make sure that they grow up to be responsible adults and have a good life. And it was sort of hard to hear, but I also, in the sustainability realm, it really hit home that I wanted to know the kids better. Like, I didn't want to be the flash in the pan, kind of exciting, whatever flavor of the year that just comes in. And so that's sort of the crack in the armor where I still traveled to quite a few other places, but as I continued to do it, it was more clear to me that I valued, when I went places, I would want to meet locals and work with them and learn from them and sort of have a mentor who would teach me maybe what was really going on, maybe the stuff that we hadn't heard of or that we weren't being told. And the more I did that, I feel like the better I got at my job, but I also started to have this real tension between, well, I would like to be that person someday. And to do that, I would have to live in a community. I would have to have a commitment to a group of people that I don't just look forward to my next year's trip or whatever. So it was just a slow burn for a few years when I had an idea to come back to Des Moines. And I shared it, and it was the idea for this nonprofit. If I couldn't get a corporate sustainability job, I had an idea for basically adult education or environmental education for adults, targeting young professionals who, you know, there is a philosophy that exists that you just teach kids and hope their parents die someday, and that's how the world gets better. And I personally don't.
There is some truth to that.
It's sort of like it's not really a strategy. It's just life.
Yeah.
You know, everybody dies. But yeah, when I was in the educational community and people were just saying, oh, we've really got to teach the kids, and it's sort of hopeless to try to work with adults. And I said, well, that's really disheartening. And if that's true, I think it's kind of pointless what we're up to right now. We should probably just give up. And so I had the idea to come back and really target adults, and I found it not only incredibly fun, but very effective. And it just took a different strategy and really finding what was relevant to people and making it not about trees and squirrels, but about their life and the car they drive and their workplace and the buildings that they go to work every day, because people are sort of disconnected from nature. So that's when I finally decided to come home, as I decided that I could start that nonprofit, if nothing else, if I don't find a corporate sustainability job.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Adam Hammes, author of Sustainable Business in Iowa. You know, for a long time, I think we thought of sustainability, particularly in terms of business, as being primarily environmental issues. And obviously, that is a very big, important part of it. But you've also, in your book and in your conversation, have included these social issues. At what point did that get rolled into the concept of sustainability?
Well, it's interesting because in the business world, if you just focus on the word sustainability, the social side is sort of all being, they kind of all converged recently in the last maybe 15 to 20 years, probably in the middle, like mid-90s is when the earliest companies started taking it very seriously and having really good success. And I would point at Interface Carpet and Ray Anderson as their CEO is sort of he was kind of looked at as the leader because he was the CEO and chairman of the company saying these things. But if you look at the history of the terminology, sustainability really came earlier, and it was in the financial world, and they really were just talking about sustaining the company financially. It was accountants talking about sustainability, and that's why there's a lot of confusion. The social came later, actually before the environmental, but people tended to refer to it as social capital or human capital or corporate social responsibility. And again, all of these things are evolving, but it was very narrow, and it was often looked at as just philanthropy, donating money. It's come a long way since then to include a lot more of the social issues, and it's very robust. And then sustainability, probably in the 60s and 70s, really started being used by the environmental movement as a global term for sustaining our global ecosystems that provide life to everything on the planet. And then it all sort of merged. And now if someone says ESG or CSR or sustainability in the corporate setting, they tend to all be talking about the same thing. If they're successful companies, and if they're not, they're probably not as successful. because it really is a balancing act of businesses don't exist if they can't make money. But they also can't deteriorate the social fabric of the communities that they're part of, and they can't deteriorate the environmental, basically the ecosystems that provide absolutely everything that they use to run a business. Like nothing comes into a business that didn't first come from some sort of ecosystem, whether it was a forest or a stream or the ocean or a mine. Or a field, you know, everything comes from nature. And so the more people are realizing that all the stuff that they want to use to run a business can't continuously be provided. And if it does, it gets very, very expensive if we just use it all up and throw it away. Mm-hmm. So we're getting a lot smarter, and we're seeing the connections between financial, social, and environmental. But still, corporate sustainability is still growing, but it's still not by any stretch of the imagination the majority of business people understand that that's the way things work. And so we're trying to keep growing that, especially here in Iowa. We're really trying to make a dent in growing the sustainability professional community to understand that all these companies should be looking at this, because it 100% affects the bottom line. And it is what people would prefer to do anyway. If you could do the right thing socially and environmentally, most people would choose to do that. But they believe that there's this tug of war that typically doesn't exist if you actually research and understand the issues that face each company.
I think, you know, obviously I agree with that. Part of the problem is sometimes just being able to figure out how to do the right thing. What is the right thing and how to do it. And it's not always simple. It's rarely simple. And it means change, which can, in any organization, people are resistant to change, systems are resistant to change. And so I think that's where an organization like yours, the Iowa Sustainable Business Forum, can help companies get over some of those obstacles. Is that kind of what your thought was in forming it?
Yes, that was the initial thought, was that, so when I started at Come and Go, I literally, it was the only job I had heard of for me that I could take. And so I was happy to have it, but then I started looking around the state to see, even if they're not by title, who are the people that might be doing what I do in other companies. And I just made an effort over the next 3.5 years to really network and find. And we found about 7 of us in Des Moines alone. And we started meeting monthly. And it was incredibly valuable to just share what we were learning and lessons and what worked, what didn't work, and why. And then we kind of ran out of our own 7 companies, and we didn't have any more stories to tell. So we started looking for other people to invite in. And then it just became clear that it was valuable enough that, you know, one of us should be willing to go start this as an organization. And I kind of had the most history in starting new things, so I jumped at the chance. But it was really about getting free ideas from peer professionals and saying, you know, this isn't very proprietary stuff. We all, if we want to recycle, we don't want other companies to fail at recycling. It's not that kind of a market. We wouldn't mind being first and getting some press out of it. But it's really doesn't make sense to not want other companies to do the right thing as well. So people tend to share really openly. And I saw that was the first barrier that came down, is peer-to-peer professional sharing really speeds up the process. There's a lack of cynicism. There's a lack of distrust. And people really believe that they understand what you're going through and are just sharing honestly what's working for them. Then, as I taught in for the University of Iowa, I taught an MBA course, CSR and sustainability, for their graduate business students. It also became clear that there were, that people didn't know how to go through the change management stages, how to shift that culture or how to change that particular initiative. And there was a lot of research on stage development and what has to happen first, and then what are good change management strategies. And so I just started poring over a lot of the research and saying, how do we apply this same stuff to these sustainability topics? And that's really what led me into wanting to write the book. And that everything that you spoke of is exactly right. In my opinion, people would do the right thing if they thought it was possible, if they saw that there was a path that worked for them. Most people just believe that they can't do it, or they don't understand. Even if they want to do it, they don't understand how to do it. And so I really wanted to lay that all out for people and just say, this is complicated, but you can simplify it if you know where to look and if you focus on specific areas. It's just a lot of information, but you can make it very manageable for people, especially if it's their job.
So in the book, you break down the journey towards sustainability into 5 stages, and those came out of a sort of your compilation of a number of different models.
Mm-hmm.
How long a process was that to kind of put that together into what seemed to you to work in this venue?
Well, I mean, it was when I actually started writing the book, if we just look at book writing, it's shorter. But I have some mentors and people that I really look up to. And one of them is Bob Willard, who is from IBM Canada and sort of retired and now just works on boards of a ton of different corporate sustainability groups. But he wrote all the books that I kind of learned from when I was young in graduate school and started taking off. And he had this 5-stage model. And it's one of the ones that I borrowed from. So I always looked at it and used it, and it was helpful, but it wasn't very detailed. It just really was the five stages and very little else. And it only applied to environmental issues. And I was always desperate to find more information. And so when I started to be an adjunct faculty for the University of Iowa, and for my class, I just started looking for more research that would support this. And what I wanted to find was a social correlate, something that would have the same five stages or some similar stage development that would make sense for these social issues that most of the companies face. And I actually just started writing the book before I had an answer. And it was about, I was halfway through the book. I had already done kind of two big re-edits and reorganizations of the book, and I was trying to fit the chapters together. So just a couple things. One, I really narrowed down, so we only have Iowa companies, and then everything, every topic I talk about, I want to break it into those stages so people know where they are, so you can assess yourself and then know where to go next. So that was like a pipe dream that I, that was the end result I wanted. So I was laying out these chapters and some of the topics. I had to meet with a bunch of professionals to make sure I was not combining two things that didn't actually make sense, because we were combining things like energy efficiency and renewable energy into one chapter, and it just, one leads into the next really nicely, especially from a business standpoint. And so I was looking for these same patterns to unfold one kind of beginning stage that gets advanced and adds in a second stage. And I didn't have any of the answers. So it took me about 4 to 5 months of just writing constantly and working with my editor, Sarah Stibitz, and she reorganized it twice. And then finally, I just happened to pick up a book, Reinventing Organizations, that I had on the shelf. And it was just a really fat book. It's like 600 pages long, and I never wanted to read it. It just looked intimidating. And then when I started reading it, within the first two chapters, I just realized, like, this is it. He's breaking social issues down into these categories that I'm familiar with, and I had no idea that that's what the book was when I bought it. Mm. So it just happened to be this serendipitous, picked up the book when I was frustrated, and then I had to reorganize the book again, and then I was able to break all the chapters into these five stages. And it's a lot of kind of boring sounding academic stuff, but I knew from the beginning what I wanted were steps that lead into each other so that people saw this as a pathway to getting sustainability done, not just an end case study of, hey, look at this great story. What's missing for most of those case studies is the 5 years it took them to get there and all the work that they did to make it that far. And I wanted to have that in the book. So,
and is sustainably ever really done?
No. It's not only is it really, I mean, if you look at this, there are some, I break this down into initiatives, and it's something that I try to remind people is the model I'm using and all the five different models I've pulled from on the research. Companies don't really go through these five stages. Their leadership might be at a certain level, but every initiative itself needs to go and develop and mature. So if you have a really good energy program, you can take it to the end and be quote unquote net zero energy. And there's certifications for that, and there's awards you can get. And it's sort of like a rubber stamp to say you are the best in the industry. It's kind of the best you can do if you're just looking at your company. Now then people can expand and they can do philanthropic things around energy. But once you're net zero, you've just got a very responsible energy program and you're the best in the industry. That doesn't mean you have a good waste program. Doesn't mean you have a good water program. It doesn't mean you have a good diversity and inclusion program, safety, health, and well, it means nothing about the rest of the company except that you have leadership that enabled you to get that far in energy. So there's the likelihood that they understand you could do the same thing in these other areas. But it does not equate to a sustainable company. So really it's not definable. You can't define what a sustainable company is, but you can achieve very clear levels of performance in all these different categories. And then it's kind of up to you as a company. It's up to the public. It's up to your consumers, to decide if that's good enough. And if there's more you could do, it's up to your employees if they think there's more you could do. But there's plenty of companies that aren't even very far down the line in these stages on any of their initiatives. And so my goal isn't to get one or two quote-unquote sustainable companies. It's to get the majority, 90% of companies that are doing something to get better in all of the different areas and have a pathway forward so that in the next 5 to 10 years, they might be quote-unquote sustainable companies, or they might meet some of these amazing performance metrics that are available. But really, we're a long ways from that, so I'm trying to make sure that we have a sustainable effort to get these companies to keep improving.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Adam Hammes, author of Sustainable Business in Iowa, How Leading Companies Profit from Environmental and Social Responsibility. Adam, can you give us just a brief summary of the five stages, and then perhaps we'll delve into one or two of the, what do you call them, issues? Or
We can do a case study from some of the chapter topics.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, I believe I have that right here in the book. So there, I mean, what I would recommend people check out, I mean, one of my favorite books is Reinventing Organizations by Frederic Laloux. He's fantastic, but there's also super old Archie Carroll. He did the four stages of the CSR pyramid back in probably the 50s, but when they were just talking about philanthropy and stuff. But the Sustainable Minerals Institute in Australia and Bob Willard's book, Five Stages of the Sustainability Journey. So there's all these, there's even a woman who did it just on reporting and has some really cool animals that she associated with the, I think it's Don Mills, and she has some, like an ostrich and a, all these fun things. So I'll just, but the stages, the boring part is all of that. If you don't want to read all that, that they all overlap and they all, what I just picked them, what I think are the most understandable labels for each stage. And they're really like a, you should think of them as a pyramid, and you need the base and then you need to go up and get up and up. And at the end, you kind of have a smaller piece, but it's held in place by all the other levels. And so the bottom stage is pre-compliance, and it just means what it sounds like. They're not even complying with the law. They're just, typically it's a startup or someone who doesn't even know what they're supposed to be doing. They're just trying to survive and make money, which to exist, every company has to do that. They have to survive, but it's a very low level of performance, and it's very tenuous, where you probably are going to get fined and go to court and get shut down and have a ton of costs associated with being in that level. The second one, even though it doesn't sound sexy, is just compliance. And that just means obeying all of the laws and not being fined, not going to court, not being shut down, and just doing the bare legal minimum, which some companies aren't doing. So it's still a step up, and you can perform as a company much greater when you don't have the risk of all of those things. It's really a cost avoidance strategy and a risk avoidance strategy at that point. Then when it actually gets sexy and people like it and think of sustainability and they think of a company doing good work, it typically isn't until this third stage, which is simply efficiency. And that stage is when people are, for the first time, measuring and managing whatever issue it is. They're collecting data on a regular basis, they're evaluating that data, and they're trying to just do continuous process improvement in whatever the category is. It's not very sexy, but it's way sexier than doing just the bare minimum. And it's the first time that people can tell stories. You can report to your employees, hey, because we're measuring and managing energy or diversity or safety, health, and wellness, you can say with clarity, we've made a 15% improvement from last year, and that's a 5% improvement over the last 5 years, or whatever it happens to be. And people actually understand it and think that that's exciting. They're like, oh, I didn't realize we were so responsible. I didn't realize we were doing good work. And you can still spend a lot of time there, and it's a lot of mostly cost savings from just becoming more efficient with all of your resources. The probably the better companies that are most well known break into stage four, and that's effectiveness. It's not even just being more efficient at what you're doing. It's doing the right things, putting your focus in the right areas. And then also effectiveness or efficiency stage three tends to be very narrow and kind of siloed, where you're not working with anybody else. Effectiveness is more of a pluralistic, is what they call it, leadership style, where you're actually working with regulators and with the DNR or with these groups that legally could be fining you, but you're opening your books, you're opening your program, and you're saying, we want help from you. We want help from maybe an industrial park, other businesses. If you're going to join the Iowa Sustainable Business Forum, you're typically in the effectiveness strategy because you're not so closed off that you're not, that you don't want to learn from other companies. And so people reach out to governments, community leaders, other businesses, and they're really trying to creatively come up with innovations and creative solutions that simple efficiency is never going to solve. And then the last stage is called integrated strategy, stage five. And that's if you've had this program, you've been measuring and managing it, and you have all these creative collaborations in stage four, you can achieve things like zero waste or landfill free and be certified to be basically the best of the best in your industry. But that's, again, only in one category. There's something called water neutrality. It's a certification you get in water. There's things in the health and wellness industry. There's things in diversity and inclusion, collaborative workspaces. So it's a company that not only do they want to be a good company and a well-known company, but they want to be a great company and the industry leader in that particular area. So if water is important to them or energy is important to them, they want to be the best. And so five is not very common. We only have two companies, for instance, in the waste category in Iowa. One is landfill free certified, that's West Liberty Foods, and the other is zero waste certified, and that's Perishable Distributors of Iowa. And so that's something that we're trying to do, is to raise the bar category by category and say, how can we get from two companies to 20 companies, or how can we get from one net zero certified company that we have in the state of Iowa to 15. You know, how do we get these companies competing on things that are good for everybody? And that's basically getting them on this treadmill of stages and saying, if you're in stage three, let's go to stage four. And if you're in stage four, let's get you to stage five. So those are the stages: pre-compliance, compliance, efficiency, effectiveness, and integrated strategy.
Now, Adam, throughout the book, you have, like you said, we talked a little bit about the chapter structure, but you also have a lot of case studies, and you have kind of Q&A, and, you know, questions and answers, or questions for the readers. You have other resources listed, so it's not just straight text. Why don't you, and graphics, you've got some great graphics in here too. So why don't you read us a couple of case studies that drill down into some of the, a couple of the environmental issues?
Yeah, sure. And I'll touch on it really quick. Every chapter is broken in by those stages, and I made it, the first part of the book is really what everyone should read. But those questions are basically what I take my master's students through, and that's how we do our assignments. So if you follow the chapters and you follow the questions, you can assess your own company. Even if they don't know you're doing it, you can assess your company. But it leads you into part two, which is all environmental chapters, and part three, which is all social chapters. And it's really, at that point, it becomes a choose-your-own-adventure book. You don't have to read the whole thing. You can just pick the chapters that you find are most relevant to the company that you work for, and you can always come back to the other ones later. So it's not really that long of a book if you use it the way it's intended. And you mentioned the business profiles that I put in. So I drew from, I think, almost 30 companies. I'll run through them really quick just so people get a sense, but it's Bankers Trust, Barilla, Casey's General Stores, Cummins, Ecolips, Envision Sports Design, Fighting Burrito, Frontier Co-op, Geonitric, Hawk, Hagee Manufacturing, Hy-Vee, Johnson Machine Works, McFarland Clinic, Meerdink Trucking, Meredith Corporation, Modus Engineering, Ruan Transportation, Shakti Kombucha, Seagwork, Sky Factory, Smithfield Foods, West Liberty Foods, and Workiva. And so hopefully people just haven't heard of some of those companies are going to get introduced to them. But every one of those has a case study somewhere in the book, either at stage 3, stage 4, or stage 5 in every chapter. So the ones you asked me to pick out, I think that would actually be interesting to people. So I'll do first from waste. I'll do the landfill free case study. I also have one for water, which is on water neutrality, which is a cool concept. And then I could pull one from social, which is more charitable giving and volunteerism. Does that sound?
That sounds great.
Great. All right. And they're only about half a page each. And so just so you know, out of context, it might sound short, but there's a whole section that describes why this case study is relevant. But I'm picking the highest stage 5 companies in each area. So case study 1, West Liberty Foods, stage 5 for waste. West Liberty Foods certified their facilities through ISO 14001 in 2003, which included process documentation and continuous improvement for waste management. At that time, President and CEO Ed Garrett committed the company to achieving landfill-free verification after a visit to a Frito-Lay plant in Illinois. Waste to landfill per year was 7.5 million pounds. By 2004, NSF International awarded West Liberty Foods third-party certification for becoming a landfill-free business. Over 60 waste streams from each facility were diverted to recycling, composting, and, as a lowest priority, waste-to-energy incineration. This year-long process was coordinated by Michelle Boney, Director of Environment, Health, and Safety. The effort itself included 1,900 team members with champions on each core team. West Liberty Foods provided new color-coded containers, clear signage, education, and games led by plant managers to reinforce learning. At one facility, the team members spoke 15 different languages, so photos were used for all the items that needed to be sorted. In 2014, West Liberty Foods produced 50,509 tons of waste. Less than one ton was sent to the landfill, or 0.0016%. Ash from the cement kiln after incineration. 49,955 tons were recycled. That's 98.9%. And 552 tons were incinerated waste to energy, 1.09%. Boney estimated they paid extra to achieve certification initially. And since certification, the company saw an increase in national media attention, resulting in more customer contracts, and waste costs continued to decrease for an overall annual savings. Gerald Lessard, the VP and COO of West Liberty Foods, said, "We've done our small part, and we hope other businesses take a look and duplicate what we've done. If we all work together, our grandchildren won't have to be concerned with some of these issues. That's the definition of a legacy. We've started something today that we hope will impact future generations." End of case study.
Were you ever at the Cider House here in Fairfield when they had the best burger in Iowa?
No, I don't think I was.
The apple mash that they used for making the cider, you know, what was left over after the cider was pressed, was fed to the cattle that they then used in the burgers they served in the restaurant.
Circular economy.
Yep, and it won best burger in Iowa. So that's kind of a cool way to reduce waste.
Yeah, very cool way. It's not rocket science, and it's really smart business.
Yes.
That's the thing that people, I think, don't realize. They have an idea that this stuff can't happen without just spending a bunch of money. But really, you might spend something, but it's an investment. And I know West Liberty Foods, Michelle Boney is the president now of our association, and she's said they've saved easily over $1 million with their landfill-free certification, and they just keep trying to take it further every year.
Okay, so, let's hear another story.
In the water chapter, stage 5 is referred to as water neutrality. And it's interesting because people talk about being like carbon neutral or net zero energy. And so basically this is it's a emerging concept of doing the same thing with water. And what would that look like? And only a few companies are working on it right now, but Cummins Central Power is one of those. So the case study, stage five for water, is on Cummins. Cummins' strategic approach to water includes conservation, risk management, community engagement, and supply chain improvements. The company reduced global water use by 19.6 million gallons from 2014 to 2015 and reduced direct water use 16% since 2010. Adjusting for hours worked, water conservation has improved 41% despite an increase of 240 location sites, including new office buildings, regional distribution centers, and acquisition of North American distributors. Lori Council, Environmental Relations Director, said, "We have a water neutrality goal because we are in areas in the world where water is very scarce. So we have committed to having 15 sites water neutral by 2020, which means we find or replace or conserve enough in our own operations to offset the use in the community." Water being an operational risk, Cummins partners with community leaders to establish conservation initiatives. Cummins has already validated 3 sites in India, with 4 more pending. Performing water balances or evaluations to identify and fix low-cost and no-cost activities, their distribution business trimmed almost 43 million gallons of water consumption. Over the past year, Cummins' efforts have been focused on validating calculation methodologies using sites implementing projects and defining project roadmaps leading to goal achievement. The Chongqing Cummins Engine Company won a Chairman's Environmental Award in 2016 after their employees implemented programs to reduce water by 24%, saving 11 million gallons annually. Cummins had set a public record or a public goal of reducing direct water use by 33%. After achieving that goal 5 years early, they will be setting a new water goal soon. Extraction and production of metals in Cummins' supply chain represents nearly 90% of their water footprint. To mitigate risk, the company is working with suppliers to develop tools for calculating the true cost of water and techniques that require less usage overall. In the past, costs such as pumping, heating, and chemical usage in water were not considered when evaluating projects. At Cummins, sustainability, particularly environmental sustainability, is critical to the company's long-term growth and profitability, said Chairman and CEO Tom Linebarger. End case study. So water is a really interesting one, especially here in Iowa. And if companies treated their water kind of like we treated waste, like there was a definite purchase, a definite use, and then we were responsible for where it went afterwards, I think that people can imagine we would have a lot less problems.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah, Des Moines is bearing the brunt of other people's poor water usage, isn't it?
And not only Des Moines, but not all cities pull from river water, but any cities that do are definitely struggling. But if you look at rural communities, you don't have to look very far to see the damage from poor water quality. And it's not just loss of a recreational asset. It's people's drinking water. It's people's well water. It's loss of our aquifers, drawing those down to the point that we won't be able to recharge them. You know, water is an interesting, it does recycle up into the clouds, but we store most of it in the ground and we're not storing it. We're using it up faster than we're putting it back. So that's just an ongoing issue that if we're not careful, in a few years we'll be like Colorado, or we'll be like the Southwest, or we'll be like California, where we're just not going to have the water that we need to do what we need to do. And then people are going to start fighting over it, which is what always happens with water. So hopefully we take it seriously.
Yeah, I think people aren't really that aware of it, of the fact that we could run out of water here. I don't hear people talk about it.
Well, I think this is just my opinion, but it's easy and sells more newspapers, or it gets more blog clicks or Facebook clicks when people make it like a battle between different groups, like rural versus urban, or you know, farmers versus city folk. And we all use the same water, but people don't want to look at the data and just say, well, whoever's using it and whoever's making it dirty, we just have less and less every year. So what are we going to do, not only to have enough, which is quantity, which people mostly don't talk about, is just the quantity of water that we need. And it's not one of those things like, oh, the aquifer's low, I guess we now need to take it seriously. If the aquifer gets low, it's not going to recharge for years, and so we need to be doing it now. But people tend to more argue about quality, and if they can pass the buck down the road, it's definitely not very, when people say take responsibility, just putting your waste in the water and letting somebody downstream deal with it is not, it's not capitalism. And it's not self-responsibility, that's for sure. It's just a simple thing of like, hey, put your trash in the trash. Don't put your trash in the public water supply.
Well, that gets us to a whole nother economic issue about capitalism and the fact that the capitalism in the West today, or at least in the U.S., doesn't actually assign all the costs in the right places, and so you don't actually have a free market because others are bearing the costs that are incurred by some, that are really being incurred by some businesses, but they don't have to pay it. And I mean, even when you talk about our military spending and who that benefits and are they really bearing the cost, and that's a whole other subject that we don't have time to get into right now. But
I can say, and I agree with you, there's a part in the beginning of the book where I briefly talk about just what is capitalism. Because a lot of people, I think, don't... One of the biggest misunderstandings that I think is not an accident is people like to use the word free market capitalism and then move on and not define what that means. And most people believe incorrectly that a free market is a market that is free to do whatever it wants. But the term free has nothing to do with no regulations or freedom from regulation. It has everything to do with the freedom of buyers and sellers to make choices and informed choices. And specifically, there's like 13 system conditions that a free market require for competition to take place. And if you look at those, they're very much in line with sustainability. There are no monopolies and there are no externalities. So businesses are responsible for all of the negative environmental and social and financial impacts that they have on the community. They're 100% responsible for that in a capitalist society, but unfortunately that's not the way we run our society. So
right.
I think people should take a look into what capitalism is and what they maybe think it is, because I rarely meet someone who knows that that's what a free market actually means.
Exactly. And yeah, but like I said, we could spend a whole hour just talking about that.
Yeah.
And we're almost out of time now. And there was one question I really wanted to ask you, Adam. A lot of businesses, including mine, the product that we actually are selling is not really an environmentally friendly thing. It's not, if we were, you know, all living off the land, this product wouldn't exist. In a way, with come and go, you know, gasoline is not, in some sense, a sustainable, long-term sustainable product. How do you, you want to do the best you can with what you've got, but sometimes I think, well, you know, it doesn't, even if we reduced waste, etc., we're still making something out of plastic that's not actually necessary for survival. How do you deal with that?
Well, products and services tend to be, this is more of an answer from like how I believe things get done.
What's a practical approach that's going to make a difference? Because I struggle with a lot of the same things, and there is no one right answer. Just like there's no one definition of sustainability that people tend to agree on. And it can be overwhelming just to try to do something good and then be constantly worrying or doubting that there might be some other negative consequence, that's going to basically make up for the good that you did with more bad.
Right. Right.
And I don't know that we'll ever escape that. And I think the honest thing to do is to, instead of just saying this is good or this is good for the environment, saying things like, well, this is good for energy efficiency. Because you can be honest about things, but you could also say it's not good for waste. You might create more waste by becoming more efficient, or you might create a social problem by solving an environmental problem. And the ideal would be to kind of solve two problems at once and look for the wins that are a win-win in multiple categories. That's not always the case. Most things have trade-offs, and I think it's better to be honest about the trade-offs and then not greenwash and try to make it sound like everything we do was good and only good and good for everybody. Almost nothing is good for everybody, and good in all ways. And so part of it is just being honest about the impacts and trying to get better in every category as we go. It's going to take a lot of innovation. And eventually, I believe it's going to take government regulation, which capitalism requires.
Right.
So I would love to see that happen. And I think that usually, if you look at the United States, unless the business community has figured out how to do something, they typically have more say in our political process. And so I'm focused on getting companies to do this. And where it lives, where they actually start to look at their products and services, typically is in stage four, where if plastic, for instance, if you make something out of plastic, typically you're just looking at waste, or you're looking at some sort of health issues because plastic has both. But if you don't even understand the waste that's coming into your building, which is all your raw materials, then you probably don't have a good sense of how much plastic you're using and why and how much it costs. And so when people start to collect that data in stage three and start to actually become more efficient, in stage four, people start asking those effective questions of, well, is plastic really the best thing we should be using? Is there actually a different substitute that we could be using? Or can we actually just redesign how we solve this problem and not use any plastic at all? But that typically, those kind of decisions, especially because they're sort of big outside the box decisions that have to be made sometimes between multiple departments and sometimes between outside entities that aren't even inside your company. Without data, those are really hard questions to have, or really hard conversations to have, and really hard questions to answer. So I focus on getting companies very mature in stage three so they can have that data and then go into more productive conversations later with people who are creative and looking at design issues and saying, is this even the right product that we should be using? And what if we change this? What if we change that? It tends to be, for that reason, a stage four type of initiative.
Right.
And it's not a great, sexy answer, but that's that's what I've noticed, and that's what seems to happen in these companies, is that if you don't understand the problem and you don't have measurements to describe the problem, then nothing ever gets done about the problem.
Well, Adam, you definitely are helping focus attention on some of the problems, and even more so on the solutions. And I want to let our listeners know that they can find more information at your website, which is, I think, eco-fluence.com.
Yep.
So that's eco-fluence.com. And we are out of time. We always end usually with a quote from my mother, but I found one today. One of my favorite quotes from Margaret Mead: never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has.
It's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Thank you, Monica. I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you. And again, the title of the book is Sustainable Business in Iowa: How Leading Companies Profit from Environmental and Social Responsibility. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.